You're listening to Radio Area.
Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon. And a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is Mike Harris on the short end of the stick. Today is Thursday, November 15th, 2012, and we're on the Jeff Rentz Radio Network, and I welcome one and all. Before we welcome our guest today, who I'll be introducing shortly, our guest tomorrow is going to be Frosty Wooldridge, and Frosty is going to talk about the impact of immigration into this country and particularly about the population issues and the stress it's going to cause on the U.S. Monday, I'm having Jim Kerwin as the guest on Monday, and he will be addressing the popular uprising, which is going on all across Europe, where Europeans are in rebellion, and why we can't bring it here to let our government know that how unhappy we are with our current situation. And then Tuesday, we're going to have Jim Fetzer, and we're going to be addressing the beginning of this crime spree by the criminal cabal, and that was the murder of President John F. Kennedy in 1963, and he's going to bring evidence on that. But today, our guest is I consider him a friend and author, Harold Covington, and I want to get Harold's take today on a couple of things, the first of which is this secessionist movement, which has swept the country like wildfire since this election of what some consider to be an illegitimate usurper sitting in the office. So with that being said, hey, Harold, how are you? Welcome to the show.
I'm okay, and I'm always glad to be here, Mike.
Well, Harold, it's always a pleasure to have you. I've gotten more comments and compliments about you and the material you present to people. So I wanted to have you on. You know, we can talk about your work as an author, which I encourage everyone to buy Harold's book. It's a quintet now called The Northwest. What is it called?
The Northwest Novels.
Yeah, the Northwest Novels. It was a quartet, now it's a quintet, I guess. There's five of them.
There's five of them now. And I might add that when I was on just a few weeks ago, I mentioned that I was still working on completing the fifth one, Freedom Sons. That is now finished. I do want to give it one more revision before I cut it loose, but that one's done now.
Well, I highly recommend that anyone within earshot, just buy one of the books. Start with Hill of the Ravens. That's the first one. But really, if you want the meat of the matter, the one that has really the template for what needs to happen in this country is The Brigade. And so you can read either of those books. They'll give you great insights into a possible solution to this horrible situation that our country finds itself in. And I highly recommend him. His name is Harold Covington. You can find them on Amazon.com. They'll be glad to ship them to you. Just you know, give me your credit card, debit card, whatever number, and they will ship you the books. You'll have them in just a couple days. And they are a fun read. It's action. It's adventure. It's suspense. It's violence. It's all kinds of stuff. If they would make this into a movie, I know that Hollywood won't because of the political dynamic to it. But if they would, it would be a blockbuster set of hits. It would be an ongoing franchise, and you would have people lined up to see them. It would make Star Wars look weak.
I don't think Hollywood's going to be making a movie out of the Brigade in view of what I do to Hollywood in one of the sections there.
Well, that's my point. Given the political dynamic of your novels, I don't think Hollywood would. But if we had a free and independent Hollywood that was not dominated by Zog, we would have a different outcome, perhaps. And you addressed that, the fact that the people of this country need another media source, another entertainment source, other than the filth that we get, the corrupted filth we get out of Hollywood. So anyway, Harold, one of the reasons I wanted you on was about this secession movement. I wanted to get your thoughts on it. So the floor is yours.
Well, I've been keeping up with it to some degree. I understand that there's now 27, not states that have petitioned for secession, but there are 27 petitions that have been filed online with the White House website. Apparently this is something the Democrats set up so that they could pretend that they're listening to people. And the thing is, you file a petition online with the White House, and if you can get 25,000 signatures, your petition will be considered by some idiot in the government or whatever it is. I'm not sure if that's exactly how it works, but look, just before I came on, I was glancing over some of my favorite reading, which is the ultra-liberal Huffington Post, and one of their columnists on there, a character named Joe Seska, who was about as red as a London double-decker bus, was ranting and screaming and yelling about this, and apparently those 27 petitions have, as I understand it, now gathered something like over 800,000 signatures between them. And Seska was ranting and raving and screaming that we're asking for unicorns and no, you know, you stupid, you know, white right-wing fools, it will never happen. We've got you where we want you, and we're going to do whatever we want, blah, 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 blah. We won. You get the idea. It's not actually the states themselves petitioning for secession. It's the people of the states in question coming with hat in hand and tugging the forelock and shuffling and tap dancing a little in front of Obama and say, oh, please, please, magic Negro, will you let us go? Well, lots of luck with that.
It worked for Moses.
Beg your pardon? Yeah,
Worked for Moses, set my people free.
It worked for Moses after Moses smote the overseer and after God smote the Egyptians. In the 1860s, 1860, 1861, this was done by the South, as I'm sure everyone remembers, and it was done in one of two legal ways back then. In some states, such as South Carolina, which was the first one to secede, had a special secession convention in either Columbia or Charleston. I think it was Charleston. Anyway, they had a special convention that was empowered by the state legislature to rule on the question, secession yay or nay. Some other states, including, I believe, my home state of North Carolina, if memory serves, actually seceded from the Union via a act of the state legislature. So you see the difference here. In those days, it was the actual state authorities, the governments of the states, that were seceding. Right now, what we've got basically is just a bunch of really ticked off people who are petitioning the White House, petitioning the dictator himself to be so kind as to, as they say, Pharaoh, let my people go. And I applaud the sentiment. I don't think anything actually is going to come of this for the simple reason that they're not going to let us.
Let me address a couple issues. You brought up some interesting points. You know, one of them is that I've heard the number of states that have now filed secession petitions is up to all 50. Only 7 more to go.
Okay.
That's a joke, since Obama was talking about all 57 states once. Now, in Arizona, we're required to have 25,000 signatures on the petitions for the White House to actually entertain the petition. My understanding is, through unofficial channels, that we have already crossed that number. Mm-hmm. And I expect that there's going to be an effort to invalidate a number of those petitions. Obviously, if you have a petition, that's something that is routinely done. And whether you're collecting petitions to run for office or for anything, people go through and actually check to make sure the people who sign are really voters and they really live where they say they do and all of that. My guess is that Arizona alone is going to have 250,000 signers on that petition. That is just my guess.
But like I say, according to that idiot on Huffington Post about an hour ago, apparently grand total, everybody, all the states, so far the signatures have topped 800,000. So, yeah, I mean, the idea itself definitely has popular appeal.
Well, let me tell you what my concern is with this secessionist movement. I am concerned that it's coming too easy. All 50 states have it now. People are collecting signatures like crazy. When I was running for governor, to collect signatures was, I'd rather have my teeth cleaned than I'd go out and collect signatures. It's that hard, and the volume required is that great. And so somebody's funding this. The money's coming from somewhere. A petition of people who go out and stand in front of the DMV in the library and other places where people congregate public access, they get paid $1.25 per signature typically if this is a signature drive to get, let's say, some ballot initiative through or candidate on something. All right, well, I hear our music, and we'll take this time to come back. We'll come back and address this. Where's the money coming from to pay for these signatures on these petitions? We'll be right back, folks. Mike Harris on the Jeff Wentz Network, and today is Thursday, November 15, 2012. And for those of you who are lucky enough to have jobs that pay on the 1st and 15th, it's payday. So spend it wisely, because in my case, it's like spitting in a hot skillet. It just evaporates instantly. Anyway, why don't you welcome our guest back today. We have author, and I'm gonna give you the title of social commentator, Harold, because you've earned it. You know, you really have. You've been a stand-up guy. You've been solid throughout this movement forever. And, you know, you've given a lot of thought to possible ways that really the essence, the core of America, you know, the people who built this country can get out with their skins without being thrown in the cooking pot by what's going on. And let's talk about, where does this money come from? You know, I mean, what's the deal here? I mean,
my understanding as to what's going on right now is that people are filing these petitions online with the White House website or whatever that is, and then the people just basically can sign the petition online. Now, I don't know, is the White House going to actually verify these signatures, and if so, are they going to charge money for the verification? So where would money come in?
Well, see, my experience has been with collecting signatures for any political movement, at least in the state of Arizona. The people who go out and collect signatures, so you go to the DMV to renew your driver's license. Well, everybody, when you walk in the DMV, the first thing they ask you is, are you a registered voter? And
right.
They say yes or no, and they give you a form, so here, fill this out, now you are. So everybody coming out of the DMV is a registered voter, so that's a really target-rich environment. So that's where collectors come in, and they'll collect signatures out there. I don't know how those signatures are being collected, but what concerns me is we just had a very corrupt Republican presidential candidate just lost big time. And we're going to talk about that later, about the demographics behind the loss. But you look at the billions of dollars that were spent on Republican races and how they got trounced. And you know, the only guy who really had a chance of winning that race was Ron Paul. And, you know, you look at how Romney, under the direction of Karl Rove and other miscreants, let's just call them that, stole the nominee from Ron Paul. You know,
well,
these guys
stole it
don't
in 2008 as well.
In 2004, in 2000, they stole with that. That was that whole Florida hanging chad thing when the U.S. Supreme Court intervened and, for the first time ever, appointed a dictator to this country, a country in
George W. Bush. Republicans really are no better for the country than Democrats. I've never really maintained that. It's just they are. My view has always been that the Republicans are a slightly lesser evil than Democrats. Also, I predicted, if you may recall, that Obama was going to win, but I would have loved to see Romney win just so I could hear Arianna Huffington and John Stewart and Michael Moore and all these lefty jackasses scream and scream and scream and holler and wave their little fisties in the air until their faces turn blue and blah, blah. I was looking forward to that, but I mean, other than that, Romney would have been just as much of a disaster for the country as Obama.
I think he would have been more of a disaster because you look at who's backing him, and if you liked George Bush, you were going to love Romney because you look at his staff that he had lined up; they were all the same neocons. And you have to look at seminal events that happen to people in their life. And if you happen to have a job in 2007, you lost it. If you happen to own a home that was foreclosed, you don't forget the party that brought you to that dance. And the Republicans, I think, because of the actions of George W. Bush, are going to be very damaged for a long time. Because, I'm sorry, people don't forget when you lose a job, and they don't forget when you lose a home. I'm not a fan of Barack Obama. Not even a little bit. But the one thing that I will commend him on is the fact that he has stood up to Israel, and we have not yet gotten ourselves involved in a war with Iran, which Netanyahu and the Neocon gang are really, really pushing for hard.
Well, if you check the headlines this morning, you'll see it's heating up over there. The Palestinians in Gaza are cutting loose with some of their rockets, and Israel is preparing to invade and slaughter God knows how many more Palestinians, so it's heating up again. Be interesting to see if Hezbollah gets involved from up in Lebanon. It could be that Netanyahu has decided that he's going to start up a little war just to back Obama into a corner. I don't know. Who knows what really goes on over there? Middle Eastern politics is Byzantine in every sense of the word. But Romney would basically have been George W. Bush's third term. I remember thinking at the time, when sometimes Obama was showing his butt really bad and Rush Limbaugh and everyone was screaming and yelling about, Republican this, Republican that, I would sit back and think, do these people really have so short a memory? Do they not remember 8 years of George W. Bush? I have no brief for Republicans as such. Like I say, I just, on a purely personal basis, would have liked to see Romney win just to watch all these liberal lefties scream and hold their breath and run around in hysterics yelling that the sky is falling. But that's just me. That's just my schadenfreude, I guess.
And they're really good at that, too. So anyway, I hear our music in the background, so stick with us, folks. We'll be right back with more from Harold Covington. Good afternoon, and welcome back to the Short End of the Stick. This is Mike Harris on the Rents Radio Network, and today our guest is author and social commentator Harold Covington. So, Harold, welcome back to the show.
Always great to be here.
And, the other thing I want to ask you about is the demographic change in this country and how the demographics have affected this election. I want to leave this as a pretty open-ended question because I want to hear what you have to say, and then I want to chime in on some of my own thoughts, but I want to hear what you have to say first.
Well, the so-called demographic change is a fancy way of saying fewer white people and more black and brown and yellow people, largely through unlimited third world immigration. The so-called changing demographics are hitting in certain key areas first, such as California, Texas, Florida. These are now majority non-white states, and they also, not coincidentally, have huge numbers of votes in the Electoral College. And although Texas didn't go blue this time, eventually that's going to happen because eventually the shift in Texas is going to be such as to take a Democratic, and that's one last bastion of the red states gone, so forth and so on. But what I would be more worried about would be Obama's coming policy, and he's already announced this, of giving the illegal immigrants a so-called path to citizenship, which basically means giving them the vote. And once all of these illegals get the vote, that's what, 20, 30 more million Democrats, especially in the key states, since the illegals tend to gravitate towards the larger and more industrial states, which in turn have, you know, more votes in the Electoral College. And so what the Democrats are trying to do is use demographic change, or you might say they're trying to fiddle the demographics of the United States in order to ensure perpetual power for themselves and a one-party state. Certain parts of this country are now, for all practical purposes, no longer recognizable as part of the United States in any sense that you or I would understand it. South Florida, parts of California, I'm told.
Well, heck, Arizona down here. I mean, there, you go anything in southern Arizona, and boy, it's not the Arizona that I grew up in.
Well, I immigrated here to Washington State from Texas. That was my last place of residence outside the Northwest homeland, and one of the things that definitely told me it was time to hit the road was, this is in College Station, Texas, which is a college town. It's not like some little town down on the Mexican border, but you would go into a grocery store or a public place of some kind, a Walmart, whatever, and you would get your stuff and you push your little cart up to the checkout line, and the little girl behind the counter or behind the cash register would greet you in Spanish first and then switch to English. There was another place I worked where I had to leave because we were doing phone support for, you know, basically a medical supply type situation. I won't get into it, but we were told that we were going to be required to learn at least one foreign language in order to assist all these customers that were calling in with the problems with their respirators and whatnot. And we would have to learn a technical vocabulary in another language, etc. And they gave us a list of languages that we could choose to learn, or at least in a basic sense, in order to assist these customers. Only one of them was a white language, Russian, which is where I picked up my fragments of Russian. All of the rest were non-white languages of various kinds. Spanish, Tagalog for the Filipinos, Chinese, that sort of stuff. Hindu, Punjabi. And so the demographic change, basically, as you call it, is the de-Americanizing of America.
Let's speak more precisely. It's the de-Caucasianizing of America. That's probably the more precise term, if I follow your line of thought here.
This country was founded by and for white people. Specifically, let's be honest, it was founded by white Anglo-Saxon Protestants back in 1776 when we were 13 colonies on the Eastern Seaboard. We went through another century of large expanding population, the westward movement, during which time, frankly, we needed immigration in order to fill up those wide open spaces. And we got immigration largely through Ellis Island, but the immigrants we were getting were Germans, Poles, Swedes, Italians, a lot of English and Anglo-Saxons, but basically it was white immigration. Oh, and of course the Irish. It was white immigration. These immigrants were assimilable. They could be melded with the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant population to produce an American nation because they were racially compatible. Unfortunately, we also got some Jews in there with that, and they are not compatible, but that's another story. But you see what I'm saying here. All those previous waves of immigrants that came through Ellis Island became Americans. They learned to speak English. Two or three generations afterwards, they were all living in suburbs and with two cars in the garage and whatnot, and they essentially melded. They became an alloy that you could actually call an American. These new waves of immigration are not racially assimilable. They're not culturally assimilable because their religion is Santeria voodoo and that sort of stuff. And they are imposing their language on us. In certain parts of California, a ballot or other government form can be obtained in, I think, something like six languages. English, Spanish, Korean, Mandarin, Chinese, Tagalog, all this sort of stuff. That's insane. History proves that no multiracial and no multicultural empire has ever survived for any length of time, the classic example being that of Rome. The long process of Rome's decline and fall began when they expanded too far beyond their natural catchment area in Europe, you might say, and they became multiracial. Rome became a polyglot city with 11 million different little minorities and cults and religions and everything like that running around, including Jews, unfortunately, and the result was you had kind of the same type of mess we had here, and eventually Rome fell, just as America will fall because of all this diversity and multiculturalism. Diversity and multiculturalism does not work. History proves this, and why exactly we can't seem to learn this lesson, I don't know.
Well, obviously we're not learning it, but I don't think it's us that wants to learn it. Okay, well, I hear music coming up here in the background, so I will hold my response because it will go longer than the time I have allowed over this bumper music. So we'll be right back in a couple of minutes, folks. Stick with us. Good afternoon and welcome back. This is A Short End of the Stick with Mike Harris, and we're on the Jeff Rentz Radio Network. Today, our guest is author and newly named social commentator, Harold Covington. Harold, welcome back to the show. I like that title for you. I think you're a good social commentator. I think you call it out as you see it, and I think you're honest, and I think that you're speaking out. And you know, why don't you fast forward for us a little bit about what do you think is going to happen? You know, as it's pretty obvious that the other racial groups vote along racial lines. Mm-hmm. Whites do not do this. We have the liberal
always been our weakness. Yeah.
And so, you know, how do we strengthen that? How do we change that? Is there anything we can do short of what you suggest in the Northwest novels that we can do? How do concerned white Americans become proactive to take back the rights that are being stripped from them?
Well, I'm in various movement groups I've been with. Everyone at one stage or another would come to me and say, well, Harold, how can we convert people to our way of thinking? How can we bring people over? You know, how can we get them to join us? So forth and so on. And I always used to tell people that we can't convince people to join us. The blacks will, the Jews will, the government will, the enemy will. I suppose it's true that even to this day, I think I can count on the fingers of my hands the number of people that I know down through the years who have been convinced that our way is the right way, that our ideas are the right ideas, that we've got the way, the truth, and the life, and made a life commitment to it, and so forth. In other words, been converted. I think I can count on the fingers of my hands the number of people who have been converted through pure reasoning. Americans, unfortunately, are not a very reason-prone people. They are gut people. They react viscerally and instinctively to outside stimuli. I don't think that you and I, sitting here talking on this radio show, even if everyone could hear us, could probably convince all that many people. Obama, however, will convince them. I think white Americans are going to get their first little jolt of reality come January the 1st when the so-called fiscal cliff hits. And all of a sudden, they get their first pay stub for January of 2013, and they see that they've got about two-thirds what they normally get. That is going to cause some screams. I think now that Obama is no longer fettered by the need to be reelected, we're going to see him in a lot more clear light. He's going to take off the mask. He's going to start doing the things that he really wants to do. And within a very short time, I think many, many people in America are going to be screaming and begging the Lord or the Great Pumpkin or something to turn the time back to November the 6th, 2012, so they can change that stupid vote that they cast for Obama. Because I find it incredible, but I think a lot of white people, even after 4 years, still just don't get it, but they will. They're going to be losing money. They're going to be losing their health care and being forced onto this bizarre government health program. And no one is really sure exactly what that's going to do. No, I don't think anybody even read the law yet. It's 2,500 pages. In very short order, I think the white people who refused to vote on a racial basis for Romney, never mind his political ideas, the fact is Romney was the white candidate, Obama was the black candidate, There are a lot of idiot whites out there who, for whatever reason in their worm-eaten minds, voted for the black candidate, and I think they're going to get a very heavy dose of buyer's remorse very quickly, because now that he no longer has to worry about re-election, Obama is, and the people who are handling Obama are free to do whatever they want for the next 4 years, and white Americans aren't going to like it. So I think that's going to definitely give us a sense of racial solidarity, at least more than we have now.
Well, I want to point out what's going on in Europe right now, because the austerity measures are kicking in. And you just mentioned the fiscal cliff that we're going to be facing here, and that's going to happen pretty soon. You know, Europe right now, you don't hear about it in our media, but if you watch Press TV or if you watch RT Russia Today, you can see the scope and scale that all of Europe is in protest mode right now, and they're taking to the streets en masse. And you know what? The funny thing is, you don't see, it's all white Europeans who are protesting, that the darker Europeans aren't. But it's the white Europeans are finally getting their awakening, if you will.
Well, in Europe, the problem is many of those countries had the Marxism light, you might call it, the social welfare state. Places like Sweden and Greece and Spain and so forth. And like I say, I've lived in Europe, and so I understand how some of that works. A lot of those Europeans are protesting against the collapse of the social welfare state, because for several generations, they've been used to just, in essence, getting pretty much anything they wanted from the government. And now all of a sudden, what's happened in Europe is what will happen here. They just plain run out of money. In essence, these left-wing governments in Europe were doing what Obama's doing now in this country. They have been buying votes with government-subsidized housing and child allowance and, you know, free medical care and this and that and the other thing. And that's how these think outfits like the Labour Party in Britain and so forth and so on, and the socialists in France, have been getting on for all these years. And now all of a sudden, eventually, the inevitable happened and they ran out of money. You see, what these people have been doing is they've been living on borrowed money, just like in this country. It's been, I don't know how many years, but we have been spending more than we've been taking in. Now, anyone who's ever tried to run a household budget should know you can't do that. Anyone who's ever let their credit cards get out of hand and all of a sudden they're looking at a $10,000 Visa bill, they can understand this. You cannot spend more than you take in. And if you do, there's only a couple of things you can do, none of which are very good. What Obama is apparently going to do, and I warned about this before the election, and now it looks like it's coming true. I noticed that Obama hadn't been reelected for more than a day when Ben Bernanke announced QE3, quantitative easing, which, in other words, the Federal Reserve is printing money. Basically, they're creating money out of nothing, and they're offering it in payment for their own bonds. In other words, people lent the United States money, and the United States gave them an IOU, and now instead of paying back the IOU with actual money, they're just printing up some monopoly money and paying it back with that. It's like
Let me ask you some questions about this, because you brought up a lot of good topics that I think need to be further explored. One of them is, you know, we're following in the footsteps of Europe, and they're taking to the streets. Is that going to happen here? What do you think? And what's the result going to be like, number one? And then number two is, you know, China is no longer buying our debt. We've just had another treasury auction. This is the fourth in a row that China has boycotted the U.S. market. So the Federal Reserve is buying up the bonds that they can turn around and lend. So essentially, there are no buyers for the U.S. Treasury notes.
The Chinese aren't stupid. They've got enough of our worthless paper. They don't want any more. Yeah, as to whether Americans will take to the streets, that's another little phrase. It's kind of like the balloon going up I mentioned before. I keep hearing this, and a lot of people in our right-wing circles or whatever you want to call them have this vision that someday Americans will, quote-unquote, take to the streets. That's something, again, I have to... I hope so, but I have to admit I'm skeptical about it. Maybe I'm just pessimistic for having worked in this milieu for 40 years and not seeing any really tangible results, but I am really skeptical as to whether there's ever going to be any kind of mass uprising of white Americans. I don't think it's going to happen. I believe that...
I'm seeing something different. I'm seeing that for the first time, the blacks are becoming alarmed that they're being displaced as the preferred minority. They're being displaced by the Hispanics, the Mexicans.
There may well be a war between the blacks and the browns, absolutely. But as for white people that grew up in my baby boom generation, I guess yours too, it's like we have this inhibitor built into us. white people don't march in the streets. White people don't demonstrate. That's what hippy-dippy anti-war protesters and black civil rights marchers and that sort of thing, that's what they do. Good white Americans don't do that sort of thing. We stay at home and go to work every day and live behind our white picket fences, and then every election day we go in and vote. That's how white people do it. This marching in the street stuff and rioting, oh, no, we're above that. We're white folks. We don't roll like that. No, yeah, you get what I'm saying here? I think a lot of us have this kind of attitude.
I think the times, they are a-changing.
I hope so. God knows it's time.
Well, what's going to happen here, I'm just going to forecast. I mean, we have what I will call the permanent underclass, which is black, white, brown. These people who are, welfare was a career choice for them, and they're the permanent underclass. And as the effects of this counterfeiting, this ramp money printing takes effect, their benefits are not going to go up in proportion to the rising prices. So let's say a single mom, let's say she's got three kids, she gets $200 a piece for these kids for food per month. And what does she do when the price of bread goes from $3 a loaf to $33 a loaf? What happens then? So that's just something. And hold the response until we get back. This is our long break here, so if you need to use the restroom, it's a good time.
Okay.
Because we have the news at the top of the hour. We'll be back in about 5 or 6 minutes. Okay, stick with us, folks. I'm Mike Harris, and this is the Jeff Rentz Radio Network. Today we have with us author and social commentator Harold Covington. Harold, welcome to the show.
Oh, always glad to be here.
Now, you've had some time to think about what I was saying before we took our break, and that is, what is the permanent underclass going to do when their benefits are fixed and the bread goes from $3 to $33? What do you predict?
Well, there was already an incident similar to this a few months ago in the state of Georgia. There was some kind of computer glitch, and all the EBT cards that are supposed to be topped up every first of the month with the welfare payments, for some reason that didn't happen. It took them about 3 days to fix it, and although there was not much media coverage about it, there was kind of on the verge of rioting in places like Atlanta and so forth like that. When you have a permanent underclass that is dependent on a government dole of any kind, be it EBT, welfare, food stamps, the fact is, when you have got any underclass like that is used to surviving on some kind of government dole, any kind of government dole, and all of a sudden that dole is cut off, you're bound to have pretty explosive consequences. And in a way, I almost can't blame them, because you've got these masses of people. And, for whatever reason, this is how they survive. This is how they've been taught to survive. I saw this in England and in Ireland, that it can happen to white people as well as non-whites. Even with the welfare state in Britain, you do have third and fourth generation welfare families, and that's white welfare families. The Limbaugh types do have a point in that when you remove any demand work, any forcing of self-reliance on people, and you get a dependent population. And so when you cut off the source of that dependent population's existence, yeah, there's probably going to be some rioting there. But I think that Obama and the Democrats are going to do anything they can to prevent that type of event from occurring, which means that they're going to have to go after, with taxation and fees and fines and that sort of stuff, they're going to have to go after the one remaining source of wealth in the country, of privately held wealth, which is basically the life savings and personal wealth of middle-aged to elderly white people. I think Obama's going to spend the next 4 years trying to get at that wealth, tax it away, drain it away. We see this with Obamacare right now. If you don't buy your Obamacare, it doesn't sound to me like they're actually going to be coming and putting people in jail. What they're going to be doing is they're going to be slapping a fine and more money on your tax bill. And eventually what the Democrats are going to do in this country is they're going to kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. They're going to tax the private sector out of existence. anybody, any businessman with any...
Well, Harold, it's just not just Democrats. And my preposition is that, you know, both parties, we don't have a two-party system anymore. We have a one-party system. And, you know, my challenge to the listeners is this. Is if you don't believe me, do a little homework and go look up on the filings as to who the top 25 donors are for both parties, the Democrat Party and the Republican Party. I'm going to promise you probably 80 or 90% of them are the same company, the same people.
Oh, yeah, that's a very common practice.
And so it's the same people are calling the tune for either party. So we're going down this road, and it's been long known that big business in this country didn't like having to provide medical benefits to their employees. It was an expense. So they wanted a national health care system. Well, they got it, but they don't have government-provided health care. It's still privately provided. So we have insurance companies who are going to be getting wealthy off this, like every other program that government has. There's some politician's friend out there who works for some company who's lining their pockets like crazy, and the people are suffering for it.
The long and short of it, Mike, is I think the best way to put it is we live in a society which is totally corrupt from top to bottom. Neither Republicans nor Democrats really have anything on each other. You might say there's a certain difference in style. I was talking about the election on my own podcast last week, and I say basically the way it usually works out is Republicans steal money, Democrats steal votes. Another one put it, Republicans are inept, Democrats are corrupt. But yeah, it's two sides of the same coin in the sense that they're both pillars of a society which is, frankly, a failed state. America doesn't work anymore. And that, in the final analysis, is what's going to bring us down. It's not so much the mere fact of corruption. I mean, we've had corruption in the United States almost since the very beginning. It's the fact that we have become so sick and corrupt and quavering with senility in our national institutions that the system doesn't work anymore. It's not functioning. It's not keeping bought off the people who should be bought off, so forth and so on. But what's going to have to happen and what will happen eventually, possibly through some financial implosion, possibly through some foreign thing that gets out of hand, there is going to be a Soviet-style breakup of the United States. I know I've mentioned this before on other shows. Maybe it sounds like I'm obsessed with it, but it's going to happen. 50 years from now, there's going to be no United States as we would recognize it. So this, of course, is the crux of my novels and the crux of my whole message of white separatism. This continent is going to break up into its various heterogeneous racial and ethnic and special interest groups. We've got to make sure that the white man survives, that the white man gets a piece of territory, hence the Northwest Republic, so forth and so on. But that is what we're heading for now. I think history will record that the beginning of the actual breakup began on November the 2nd, 2012.
Now, the way I look at the two parties is they each have separate constituencies, and their constituencies make demands of them. I look at the Republicans as being the war party, and I look at the Democrats as being the welfare party. And quite frankly, I find both of them unpalatable, and I want a better form of government. I want better choices. What do you recommend?
Well, if people want to go to our website at www.northwestfront.org, there's a section on there where they can see the draft constitution of the Northwest American Republic. This is not written in stone yet, but it was an actual document that we came up with. It's not just something that I wrote either. This was done in consultation back in 2006 with a number of fairly prominent people within our movement, including some of the order men who contributed from prison. And so this is a group effort. In essence, what we create in the Northwest in our draft constitution is a society that is genuinely based on merit and where rights are the result of responsibility fulfilled. I won't get into the actual structure of government, although we do streamline it quite a bit. For example, there's not two houses of the legislature. It's only one. It's unicameral. My novel is referred to as Parliament, and the Constitution is referred to as a National Convention. We have a state president. He is elected for 1 6-year term. He cannot run for another consecutive term, so there are some checks and balances. We do not have a judicial branch of government at all. It is stated in the Constitution that the function of the judiciary is to find fact in legal and criminal cases. The judiciary has no constitutional role at all. But anyway, there are differences. A lot of the things in the Northwest Constitution have to do with correcting problems that occurred in the U.S. Constitution. But we lay out in this new Constitution a whole new form of government. It's for our Northwest Republic, but I think it would be applicable in any kind of white ethno state.
Okay, well, when we come back, I want to ask you some more about the parliament-type system here. We'll be right back right after this break, folks. Stick with us. Good afternoon and welcome back to The Short End of the Stick. This is Mike Harris of Rents Radio Network, and today our guest is author and social commentator Harold Covington. Harold, welcome back to the show.
Okay.
So, you know, what do you want to talk about next? You know, you're talking about your constitution here, and people should read this, and this parliamentary system here. If we look at the European parliaments, you know, primarily, let's take Great Britain, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
The United Kingdom is where they call it these days. They have different parties within a unicameral body, but they also have another supervisory body on there called the House of Lords versus the House of Commons. I look at the flaws in our system here currently with our, you know, the Senate was the equivalent of the House of Lords, you know, where people, our senators were formally appointed by state legislatures.
Right.
That's not done anymore. It's popular election, a corruption of process. And then our Congress was supposed to be the people's house. Well, it's no longer the people's house. It's the corporation's house. Because 96% of the time, the candidate with the most money in this country wins. And 70% of the money that's donated to people seeking office comes from corporations. It doesn't come from people. And fewer than 4% of the registered voters actually make any political contributions at all. And then people sit back and whine because we get crummy choices.
Well, this is one of the reasons I described our society as corrupt from top to bottom. If I seriously thought that there was any chance at all for democratic or electoral change in this country, I wouldn't be writing these novels. But yeah, in Europe, they have a system in some countries called proportional representation. Basically, you have many parties in most European countries. It's very rare in a European country to have only two parties. Usually, you've got at least, you know, four or five. But they run in an election, and any party that gets above, say, 5% of the vote or some fairly, you know, reasonable figure like that gets so many seats in the legislature. And what each party does is it puts up a list of candidates, and if you win six seats in the legislature, your first six candidates become part of the Knesset or the Duma or whatever. And this is a much more fair system. If you're going to have a democracy, this is the way to do it because it allows for other viewpoints. It also means that you get to play coalition. We had this when I was living in Ireland a lot. I don't think, and if memory serves, all the time I was living there, I don't think we ever had a single party in power in Ireland. You always had some kind of coalition between Fianna Fáil and Labour or Fine Gael and Labour, whatever. Now, that's the fair way to do it if you want to run a democracy. The problem is in America, basically, you've got two candidates, and whoever gets the most votes wins, unless, of course, you're in a presidential race, in which case, whoever swings about 8 or 9 specific states wins. Now, this is not really democratic. Never mind whether or not you like democracy as a form of government. The fact is, it isn't fair. It isn't democratic because it puts too much weight in the hands of what I call non-producers. Now, in our Northwest Constitution, we have different grades of citizenship, first class. Now, when a young man in the Northwest Republic of the future graduates high school, he does 2 years in the labor service, digging the ditches, hauling the garbage, doing all the work that normally is done by Mexicans in this society. Then he does 2 years in the Army, goes into the reserves, etc. At that point, he's about 21 years old, say, and he has completed his national service, and he gets, among other things, admission to the college or technical school of his choice. He's ready to begin life, and he gets third-class citizenship, which is one vote. As he goes on through life, through various achievements, he gets second-class citizenship, which is two votes. And finally, once he passes the age of, say, 45, he gets first-class citizenship, which is three votes. And what this does in our system, it allows the people who have demonstrated the most responsibility, who have served the state, who have served society, and who have proven that they have enough intelligence and civic commitment to understand the issues, so forth and so forth, to exercise the most degree of power and influence within the state. In our, you know, idealized Northwest Republic, which, by the way, is also helped by having a racially homogenous population, all this stuff, you know, it'll only work with white people. But what we do is we actually make it hard to get into politics. You have to actually work at it. You have to show responsibility. You can't just do like in this country, just walk up and pay a filing fee and say, hey, I'm a Democrat, come vote for me. I'm going to give you this and that and the other thing. I believe it was some Scottish economist who wrote that democracy always fails when men discover that they can vote themselves money from the public funds. We try to avoid that.
You bring up a good point there, because you look at our situation in this country right now, and you realize that nearly 60% of people out there pay no income tax, none, and they have no skin in the game. And I hear
but they have a vote.
But they have a vote. And so let's talk about this when we get back from this break. We'll be back in a couple of minutes, folks. Stick with us. This is Mark Karras on the Rents Radio Network. And before we go back and talk to our guest, I want to announce tomorrow I have Frosty Wooldridge on the show. And Monday, he's going to be followed by Jim Kerwin on Monday. And then Tuesday, you're going to have Jim Fetzer. These are all three very, very interesting guests. Frosty's going to be discussing the immigration issue, both legal and illegal. And Jim, I'm not sure what he's going to talk about. I think he's going to talk about the theft of America and how we're becoming a police state. And Jim Fetzer is going to talk about the JFK assassination, the murder of an outstanding president, and, you know, the lack of consequences for that murder. So anyway, Harold, welcome back. And let's pick up where we left off. Let's talk about this parliamentary system a little bit more, and how nobody in this country has, over 60% of our population has no skin in the game.
Mm-hmm.
They might pay sales tax, they might pay FICA, but they don't pay the bills.
They don't pay the bills, but the people who do pay the bills effectively have no access to the political system or to government. It is impossible to run even the smallest political campaign in this country for election to office without just oodles and oodles and oodles of money. And in order to get that money, anyone who does want to run for office has to end up compromising and twisting their principles into, you know, unrecognizable shapes. We have a system that, well, not only is corrupt, but it is corrupting. Anyone who goes into politics with this naive idea that they're really going to make a difference and they're really going to accomplish something for the country and maybe restore the Constitution, that sort of stuff, they get very quickly disillusioned, because not only does the political system run on money, but it runs on huge, huge amounts of money. I can't remember what the exact figure is, but the total amount of money that was spent on this last presidential election, including the presidential races, the congressional races, everything, runs into the billions of dollars. Now, you really have to wonder, what could we be doing with that money?
The most recent number I have on that is over $6 billion,
yeah,
just for Congress, Senate, and presidential races. For those,
yeah,
three federal groups of federal offices, was over $6 billion.
Yeah, all racial and political ideology aside, that's wrong. I mean, that is just really screwed up. Like I say, what could this country do with $6 billion for its roads, its power grid, for all of the things in the infrastructure that need fixing? So, yeah, part of it is the Citizens United decision, which allows corporations to basically act as individual people, but the system was corrupt long before that. A lot of it, I think, has to do with television. You'll probably find that most of that $6 billion went into television advertising, also things like polls and consultants and this, that, and the other thing. Back in the old days, who was it, Teddy Roosevelt, who used to do whistle-stop tours? He would ride a train all over the country.
Yeah, and here and there and give a speech upon television.
Yeah, he'd just pull into a station, he'd stand on the caboose, give a speech, and then they'd move on to the next station. And we don't do that anymore. We have to grab hold of the airwaves and all that stuff.
One of the other big corruptors of our political system, and what really made the House of Representatives, the Congress itself, you know, the House of Representatives, what really disenfranchised the voters more was the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform. It used to be, if you were a congressman from Iowa, you had to raise your money in Iowa. You didn't go out of state to raise your money. But McCain-Feingold changed that so that certain centers in New York or Hollywood or maybe South Palm Beach, Florida, where certain people live, they could generate a lot of cash and bundle it and give it to a candidate that they favored, maybe from Iowa. And so you have the people of Iowa who used to fund that candidate are now disenfranchised, and they're being outbid for their representative. The Zionist and other influence outbid the local residents for the privilege of deciding who's going to serve them and their interest in their jurisdiction.
Yeah. Basically, we have a political system in this country which is based on a cash register. We're not a democracy. We're not even a republic, particularly. We're a plutocracy. When money commands the political process, I don't know what else you can call it except a plutocracy. And, of course, it's also complicated by being a weirdo, socialist, leftist, liberal, Judaic plutocracy.
It really is. But you look at capitalism in its raw form and communism in its raw form, and the net result is the same, is that you have a very, very small select group of elite, whether they're very wealthy or whether they're very politically powerful. In the Soviet Union, you used to have these Politburos. You have the Politburo for agriculture and the Politburo for industry, and have these things. Well, now we have these things like the Council on Foreign Relations. We have the Bilderberger Group. We have the Trilateral Commissions. They're the same function, just a different name.
Well, communism and capitalism are, in one sense, two sides of the same coin. They are both essentially Jewish philosophies of pure materialism. Both communism and capitalism view mankind as an economic unit of production and consumption. To both the communist and the capitalist, human beings and human souls are reduced to numbers on a balance sheet. They are both purely materialistic worldviews. Except that capitalism allows for religion, is what Marx called the opiate of the masses, and communism doesn't. But we have to restore the quality of life, the essence of the human soul, as you will, into our national life. Life is not just about economics. This is a problem I have with people like Rush Limbaugh and a lot of these conservative types, Tea Party types, etc. To them, as legitimate as their complaints are, it's all about economics. The so-called social issues have been pushed into the background, and above all, the question of race has been pushed into the background. Life is more than pure economics. As the saying goes, man does not live by bread alone, and both communism and capitalism are, in essence, purely materialistic worldviews based on economics only. This is why we have to find a third way.
Well, I think you're onto something, and when we get back, I'm going to ask you about what's going on in Greece and the rise of the Golden Dawn and get your opinion on that. So we'll be right back in a few minutes, folks. This is Mike Harris on the Jeff French Radio Network, and today is Thursday, November 15th, 2012. We're on with special guest author and social commentator Harold Covington. And Harold, I was asking you before the break about the rise of the Golden Dawn in Greece. You know, what's your opinion of this phenomenon? Because you go back just 3 years ago, they had less than 0.25% of the national vote, and they're forecast to be over 30% of the national vote within a year. Phenomenal rise. What do you attribute this to?
Well, the Greek nation is plunging over the abyss. They're the first ones to really do so. They are completely bankrupt. The so-called social safety net that they had for many years is now gone. Again, as I said before, you can't just keep on spending and spending and spending more than you take in. And when you do that, you're headed for trouble. And Greece, being a small country, they are kind of the first, along with Ireland, I think Spain, to fall over the edge. And the result is they're having to cut back and take away a lot of things that people were used to having. And that's bad enough. But Greece also has a very severe problem, just like many white countries do, with illegal immigration. And so what's happening in Greece is that while the Greek people themselves are losing all these benefits and these pensions and these, you know, early retirements and a lot of the things that they've been used to having, you know, medical care and so forth, they look over and they see that their country is full of these non-white African and third world immigrants who are doing pretty much the same thing they're doing here. They're coming into these white countries and they're leeching off the system. And all of a sudden, it's finally dawned on the Greek people, just as it will eventually dawn on white people everywhere. Little light bulbs going to come on over their heads that, hey, we've got 10 million unemployed people in this country. We've also got 10 million illegal third world immigrants. Could there be a correlation between this? And so the combination of unchecked immigration with financial collapse is a pretty volatile one, and that's what's going to happen is you're going to see polarizing in these countries that are collapsing in Europe and eventually here between left and right. The other big growing party in Greece is, I can't remember the name of it, but it's basically the Communist Party. And the Golden Dawn is capitalizing on the fact that democracy and the social welfare state simply doesn't work. They are the first country where there is some approximation of collapse, and they're, you know, capitalizing on it. I hope they'll be able to actually seize power, get Greece out of that Eurozone, and get their country back on the track, get those illegals out of there, and restore their country to what the Greek people themselves want it to be. And yes, I've seen videos on YouTube of Golden Dawn members going into these illegal immigrant bazaars and knocking nappy heads, and I think that's what seems to fascinate a lot of our people about them, and I wish them all the best. I hope they know what they're doing, and I hope they can win through.
Well, let me ask you a tough question here, because this is a problem we have. And Obama's talking about revising our immigration laws again and finding some path to citizenship for these illegal immigrants. I don't think that's the right way to go. I think we need to deport these people. But I just want to know what's your take on this. We have 50 million of them in this country. You know, I mean, what kills me about this is our government lies so much, and they've been lying for a long time about this. And Bush wanted that border open because of the drug business that his family controls. But they've been telling us 11 or 12 million illegals for the last 15 years. And I know for a fact there's 7,000 a night coming through Arizona. And so we're up to 50 million illegal aliens in this country, and our government's not acknowledging it. What do we do with these people?
Okay, this is where we get into my novels. Okay, let's be very blunt and very realistic here. We've got two choices as to what we can do with these people. We can force them back south of the border using armed force, or we can simply kill them. Neither of these two alternatives really is very practical in the sense that neither of them is going to happen, because the United States government in its present form does not have the political will to do anything that's going to get rid of these people one way or the other, because to do so would involve being mean to them. You can't be mean and cruel to these people. And so the result is there's now just so many of them that rather than take the necessary effort and stiffen their spines and stiffen their moral guts to the point where they could actually get rid of them and do what has to be done to get rid of them, they're going to give in and they're going to let them stay, because it's better to let them stay and destroy the country than be unkind or cruel to those poor little brown people. So that's what's going to happen. But Mike, we're not going to get rid of them because the United States government won't do it. Now,
But Eisenhower did that back in the late 50s, the Operation Wetback, and he only had 1,400 border control agents.
This is the 1950s, and they
deported 1.4 million of them, and then Reagan sold us down the river.
Yeah, this is the 1950s,
though.
Which was
supposed to be an amnesty for 800.
You've got to bear in mind, the America of Eisenhower's time and the America of today were two different animals. The America of the 1950s was a white country where white people were in control. including in the South, because the desegregation hadn't hit yet, and white Americans had the will to do what had to be done. It's not generally known that in the 19th century there were something like 2 million Chinese on the West Coast at one stage. They were brought in to work on the railroads, they had unrestricted immigration, and, well, I don't know about 2 million, but they were just some huge, immense number of Chinese. Put it that way, there were Chinatowns all up and down the West Coast. In 1898, I believe it was, Congress passed a Chinese Exclusion Act and forcibly deported the bulk of them. So we have done it before, but the fact is we don't have the political will to do it again. So practically speaking, whether we like it or not, Mike, and I definitely don't like it, they're here to stay. So this is going to contribute to that Soviet-style breakup I mentioned, and this is where the Northwest Republic comes in. The white man is going to have to take back part of this country to make sure that there is a territory, a piece of turf, a homeland for white people only. If we don't do that, then we are not going to survive as a race. Of all of the races on the face of the earth, only the white race is in danger of imminent extinction. That has to change, and in order to do that, we have to have our own country.
Not only that, but you look at how successful racially homogenous societies are. You look at Japan, been extremely successful commercially. You look at China, extremely successful commercially. And you look at the U.S., and we've lost our edge. As the demographics change, we become less competitive.
That's good.
And, you know, any thoughts on that?
Well, that's because multiracial and multicultural empires do not survive, and they don't even thrive. Again, history proves this time and time again. I'll tell you who else made this observation was Adolf Hitler about his own country of birth, the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Yeah,
of the
Patrick Buchanan made the same, our current Patrick Buchanan, former presidential candidate, made the same observation.
Yeah, well, it's true. It's simply a historical fact. One of the strengths of any nation or any empire is being racially homogenous, at the very least, in its governing and ruling elite. Now, you could say that the British Empire of the 19th century was multiracial in the sense that they were, ruling millions and millions of, Wogs and Blacks. But the thing is that the British themselves were racially homogenous, and there was never any doubt as to who was in charge. You know, the white man, especially the British white man, was on top, and the local native or whoever he might be was, on the bottom, and that was it. And also there were very strong social and legal prohibitions against race mixing, so you couldn't really say that the British Empire of Victoria's time was multiracial, even though it did have different races living in it. But, a true multiracial and diverse or racially mixed empire just simply will not survive. Well, it's not only going to perish, but it's going to perish pretty quickly. These empires not only don't survive, they don't last long at all once the rot really sets in.
Well, Harold, I want you to give out your website again so people who want to go research the Constitution you've written for this and other information about what your organization is, what your philosophy is, and see if it's something that they're willing to embrace.
Well,
please give it out.
Our group is called the Northwest Front. We are a political movement for independence for the Pacific Northwest as a white homeland for all white peoples the world over. Our website is www.northwestfront, all one word, northwestfront.org. And we have a second website at www.northwestfront, all one word, northwestfront.net. And I myself have a regular weekly podcast of a little over an hour called Radio Free Northwest. So when you go to northwestfront.org, you can not only read about the Northwest Constitution, we have a copy of it there on the website, but you can also download or listen to my dulcet tones on Radio Free Northwest.
Okay, well, we've got about a minute left here. Anything else you want to tell the listeners before we run out of time and our music starts?
I personally believe that when historians sit down to write the history of the United States of America many hundreds of years from now, they will record that America was born on July the 4th, 1776, and it died on November the 6th, 2012. I think I mentioned in the last time I was on here with you, Mike, that the fall of Rome officially took place in, I think, 486 A.D., when this young emperor handed over to a Germanic king, but nobody at the time knew that Rome had fallen. I think our Rome, our America, fell on November the 6th, 2012, but we just don't know it yet.
Well, Harold, on those encouraging words, this is the end of our show. I want to thank you again for being a guest, and I'd like to invite you back, at least once a month. So,
okay. I look forward to it.
But for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington, 98310, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.